Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Exodus chapter 16. Our context is this. In our last chapter, chapter 15, we read the song of Moses, and we read about how bitter water was made sweet at Marah. We are on the Exodus. The Israelites have left Succoth, their staging ground, and people disagree on this because nobody knows exactly where they went, but according to the view that I've taken here, just for the sake of convenience, we will have them just past the northern tip of the western arm of the Red Sea, namely the Gulf of Suez. They have left Pihahiroth and Baal-Zephon, and they've gone past Marah, where the bitter waters were made sweet, and then they went to Elim, moving on down the eastern coast of the Gulf of Suez. And Elim was the place where there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. And now they go a little bit further south, and they're in the wilderness of Sin. So let's start now in Exodus 16:1. Then they set out from Elim. That's the place where there were 12 palm trees and 70 springs of water. Actually, I've got that backwards. There were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms. They set out from there, and all the congregation of the sons of Israel came to the wilderness of Sin. Now, the wilderness of Sin is somewhere about halfway down the Gulf of Suez, the western arm of the Red Sea. And if you've got the Gulf of Suez to your back and you're facing the desert of Sin and you keep going, you're going to end up somewhere just a little bit north of Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. And of course, people don't know exactly where Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai is either. Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai are probably two peaks of the same mountain range. But this to give you a general idea. That's where we are, halfway down the Sinai Peninsula. And it's desert. That's why they call it desert, a wilderness of sin. And by the way, sin has nothing to do with transgressions against the holy law of God. It's just an artifact of language, a coincidence that it's called sin. Some people say it comes from Sinai. But whatever, it's the wilderness of sin. It's between Elim and Sinai. That's because if you've got Elim to your back and you're heading south, Elim is to your back and Sinai is to your front, and the wilderness of sin is in the middle. This is on the 15th day of the second month after the departure from the land of Egypt. Remember, the first month was Nisan. They left on Nisan the 15th after having the Passover on the 14th. So this is about a month later. Second month is Iyar. So they've been gone about a month now. We go now to Exodus 16, verses 2 and 3. The whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The sons of Israel said to Moses and Aaron, "Would that we had died by the Lord's hand in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, when we ate bread to the full, for you have brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." I mean, the grumbling Israelites acted like Moses and Aaron delighted in the fact that they didn't have any food. Now, of course, they just had water given to them supernaturally when the bitter waters at Marah were turned sweet. And then when they went a little further, they were in the oasis there where there were 12 springs of water. They had plenty of water now, but no, that's not enough. Now they got to grumble about the lack of food. They've already seen a miraculous deliverance from Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, Pharaoh's army humbled and destroyed, water miraculously provided to them in the middle of the desert. But oh no, now they got to start grumbling again, because now they don't have any food. Adam Clark says they were in a state of great mental degradation owing to their long and oppressive vassalage and had no firmness of character. Well, I agree with that. They had no firmness of character. The Israelites always griped. They always constantly grumbled. Exodus 16:2, the whole congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. That's our verse here. The next chapter, Exodus 17:3, but the people thirsted there for water, and they grumbled against Moses and said, I think that's Rephidim where they were, "Why now have you brought us from Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Numbers 14:2, all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Egypt, and would we had died in the wilderness." That sounds very similar to what we read here. Numbers 16:11, therefore you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord, but as for Aaron, who is he that you grumble against him? Numbers 16:41, but on the next day all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You are the ones who have caused the death of the Lord's people." Once again, I mean, that's slander. That's treason. You're saying that Moses and Aaron deliberately tried to kill you? But in reality, they weren't grumbling against Moses and Aaron. They were grumbling against somebody much more powerful and mighty than Moses and Aaron, namely Yahweh, the Lord. Exodus 16:8. Moses said this will happen. Of course, this is in our chapter. We'll read this in just a minute. This will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning, for the Lord hears your grumblings, what you grumble against him. And what are we, i.e., who are Moses and Aaron? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord. Paul warns the Christians not to follow the Israelites' example of grumbling, 1 Corinthians 10:10, nor grumble as some of them did. Don't grumble as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. The idea, as Paul saying, is grumbling is the predecessor event to destruction. You want to get destroyed? Complain, gripe, and moan. Bitch, moan, and whine. I don't like the color of the carpet. I don't like the way the preacher parts his hair. You know, these important things that get us all upset. Just a simple little word of exhortation. We ought not to do that. Now, the grumbling Israelites said, would that we had died by the Lord's hand. They're probably referring to one of those plagues that hit Egypt. They are saying they'd rather die of a plague than they would die of hunger in the wilderness. Well, I think both would be unpleasant, but why would you say that you would rather die of the plague? That would be bad, too. This is what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says. Now, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown are going to point out that these Israelites, although they shouldn't have grumbled, and they showed a lack of character, nonetheless, we need to appreciate the situation they were in. Because I'll be honest with you, I think if I had been in their situation, I probably would have grumbled, too. So let's read what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. How unreasonable and absurd the charge against Moses and Aaron. How ungrateful and impious against God. After all their experience of the divine wisdom, goodness, and power, we pause and wonder over the sacred narrative of their hardness and unbelief. But the expression of feeling is contagious in so vast a multitude, and there is a feeling of solitude and despondency in the desert which numbers cannot dispel. And besides, we must remember that they were men engrossed with the present, that the Comforter was not then given, the Holy Spirit, and that they were destitute of all visible means of sustenance and cut off from every visible comfort, with only the promise of an unseen God to look as to the ground of their hope. And though we may lament they should tempt God in the wilderness and freely admit their sin in so doing, we can be at no loss for a reason why those who had all their lives been accustomed to walk by sight should, in circumstances of unparalleled difficulty and perplexity, find it hard to walk by faith. In other words, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, they're culpable, but their guilt is understandable, and it is understandable. They were in a hard place, in the middle of a desert, a long way from the promised land, with their women and children, and they didn't have any food. So I guess we ought not to be too hard on them. Now in verse 3, the grumbling Israelites say, oh, in Egypt we sat by pots of meat. Now, of course, what they didn't mention was that those pots of meat were put there for the Hebrew slaves by the slave masters. They were put up there, probably, large pots for cooking the slaves' food, as Adam Clark says, and so the Israelites conveniently forgot here to mention they were eating food as slaves. Here's another verse showing about how they longed for Egypt, Numbers 11:5. We remember the fish which we used to eat free in Egypt, the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlics. Oh, how wonderful it was to be a slave in Egypt. Remember that Keith Green song, so you want to go back to Egypt where you're safe and secure? Well, folks, that's human nature. Great application here. Sometimes we'd rather be slaves than free because freedom has a lot of responsibility and a lot of terrifying events in our lives that come in our lives when we're free. Most people will choose security and slavery any day over freedom. I think of all these people in China when these college kids, and they're worried about their future, and every now and then you'd run into one who'd say, I want a state job. It's secure. It might be boring, and I might be a slave, but at least I know that I have a paycheck and I can eat. Now, there were a lot of more entrepreneurial types who wouldn't take that attitude, but by golly, there's a lot of people who'd just be happy with a state job. Slavery! Security! Now, the grumbling Israelites said they were going to be killed by Moses and Aaron with hunger in verse 3. Now, think about this. Hunger? Well, they had unleavened bread for a while. They'd been gone for about a month. The unleavened bread had probably run out, as John Gill says, but they still had their flocks and herds, lots of sheep, lots of oxen. How were they going to starve to death? Well, here's some options to solve that problem. First of all, they needed to keep those flocks alive because they needed to breed future flocks. You start killing your flocks off, you've killed your future. And they needed those flocks for sacrifice to God, too, actually. Or it could be that this idea of hunger was not really true, they knew they could kill their flocks and eat, so they knew they weren't going to starve of hunger. But they didn't really care because they just wanted to go back. They didn't care whether they were hungry or not. They were just using that as an excuse to blame Moses and Aaron because they wanted to go back to Egypt where it was safe and secure, whether they had flocks to sacrifice or not. They were in the desert. Now, in the desert, there were only wild olives and wild honey. It was the only other food in the desert they could eat. Deuteronomy 32:13 says this, He, that's God, made Jacob, the people of Israel. God made Israel ride on the high places of the earth, and he ate the produce of the field, and he made him suck honey from the rock, there's your honey, and oil from the flinty rock, there's your olive oils, because olive oil grew on olive trees. If you've seen them in Israel, they're kind of squat trees that grow in the dry, arid desert land. Honey and oil, but no meat. So now the Israelites are complaining. So we go to verse 16, 4. Then the Lord said to Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you. Now the first thing we notice here is this is a pretty gracious response. As Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say, God gives them bread instead of chastisement. Instead of saying, why do you people grumble all the time? He says, okay, you grumbling, I'll give you bread. And people say there's no grace in the Old Testament. Well, here's an example of it right here. I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day that I may test them whether or not they will walk in my instruction. Now, this phrase, bread from heaven, was used many times by Jesus, because Jesus is the manna, the New Testament manna. He's the fulfillment of that type. John 6, 32 through 33, Jesus then said to them, Truly, truly, I say to you, it is not Moses who has given you the bread out of heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread out of heaven. So there, Jesus fulfills that type for us nicely. We don't have to argue over how that type works. Verse 33, John 6, For the bread of God is that which comes down out of heaven and gives life to the world. So Jesus is manna. John 6, 35, Jesus said to them, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will not hunger. John 6, 48, I am the bread of life. John 6, 51, I am the living bread that came down out of heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread also which I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. John 6, 63, it is the spirit who gives life. The flesh profits nothing. The words that I have spoken to you are spirit and are life. So Jesus is the bread who gives life, and then he says in John 6:3, it's the Spirit who gives life, so the bread is like the Spirit that gives life to people. Matthew 4:4, but he answered to the devil, Jesus did, It is written, Man shall not live on bread alone, but on every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. So Jesus is now saying that he is bread that keeps us alive. He's the manna from heaven. Jesus was quoting Deuteronomy there, Deuteronomy 8:3, He humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you understand that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by everything that proceeds out of the mouth of the Lord. Okay, so the bread is symbolic of Jesus who gives life. It's symbolic of the Holy Spirit. It's symbolic of words that proceed out of the mouth of the Lord that feeds us. The bread is that which gives life. The Spirit gives life. The bread gives life. The words of God proceeding out of the mouth of God give life. Now, in verse 4, God says, Moses, the people should go out, says to Moses, the people should go out and gather a day's portion every day. It was daily manna, i.e. daily bread. Just like in the Lord's Prayer, Matthew 6:11, give us this day our daily bread. Give us this day, one day, our daily bread. Luke 11:3, give us each day our daily bread. And, of course, the object lesson that God's trying to teach the Israelites here is don't worry about the future. I got it all covered. You just worry about one day at a time, just like on the Sermon on the Mount. Now, God says that this giving of manna every day is that I may, quote, unquote, test them. Test means to try, to put through the test to see whether one is approved or not. Now, if you say, well, does God test his people? Oh, yes, he does. He, for example, tested the people of Israel at the bitter waters of Marah in the last chapter, Exodus 15:25. So he, Moses, cried out to the Lord because of the bitter water, and the Lord showed him a tree, showed Moses a tree. When Moses threw it into the water became drinkable. The Lord made a statute and ordinance for them at Marah, and he tested them there. Marah means bitter, and he tested them there. He was testing them to see if they would trust in him to give them water when they needed water to drink. He was trying to build their faith to see if they would trust in him, because it is not a natural thing for people who walk by sight to believe in an unseen God. It's just not natural. We don't like to believe in things we can't see. And God says, I'm going to prove to you that you can trust me whom you cannot see. So he tested them by depriving them of water, and then when they were at their wits' end, Then he gave them water, just like he's depriving them of food because they are worried about dying of hunger, and then he gives them food. God also tested the people at the giving of the Ten Commandments, Exodus 20:20. Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you." And that's because of all the lightning and the smoke and the thunder. And people said, no. We don't want to talk to Moses. We don't want to talk to God. We don't want to be around this. We can't deal with this. And Moses said, "Hey, God's testing you to see if you're going to believe in him, in order that the fear of him may remain with you so that you may not sin." So God does test his people. We go to Exodus 16:5. "On the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as what as they gather daily." That's so they can have enough for the seventh day, the Sabbath. We read it in verse 23 of this same chapter later on. "Then he," God, "said to them, 'This is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath day.'" Actually, that he might be Moses. "Moses said to them, 'This is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over you put aside to be kept until the morning.'" In other words, bake enough for the people in your family to eat what they need to eat, baked and boil what they need to eat, boiled, and that's it. You don't need to worry about tomorrow. God's going to take care of it. Because on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be no manna. You can't go out and collect it, but you'll have stuff left over. Exodus 16:26, 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. Now, what a great object lesson this is. If you will give one day of the week to the Lord, God will provide you extra during the earlier 6 days of the week to make up for that which you didn't get on the seventh. How many times is that violated by Christians? And I'm not a Christian Sabbatarian. I don't believe that either Saturday or Sunday is a fixed ordinance of the law, but I do believe that it is written into our makeup, our DNA, that we need to take some time off to rest during the week, and God will make up for it. I'm not going to get into what day it is, Saturday or Sunday. I'm not going to talk about what rest is constituted of. Is playing baseball, is that work? Is cutting your grass, is work? No, the idea is you rest from what you normally do during the 6 days, the things that wear you out if you keep at it. You need to rest, you need to recuperate. That's just human nature, it's the way we're made. So I think, again, the lack of manna on the seventh day is a good object lesson for us also. So we have the lesson of daily provision. Don't worry about tomorrow, but only sufficient of the worries of today. Great object lesson there. And then also, you need to rest one day out of seven. Exodus 16, verses 6 through 8. "So Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, 'At evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning you will see the glory of the Lord, for he hears your grumblings against the Lord. And what are we that you grumble against us?'" We meaning Moses and Aaron. "Moses said, 'This will happen when the Lord gives you meat to eat in the evening and bread to the full in the morning, for the Lord hears your grumblings which you grumble against him. And what are we, Moses and Aaron? Your grumblings are not against us, but against the Lord.'" Now, when Moses and Aaron said to all the sons of Israel, that would be Aaron because he's speaking in the name of Moses. He was his mouthpiece. "At evening you will know that the Lord has brought you out of the land of Egypt, because at evening is when all the quail are going to come and land in the camp of Israel." Now, it's interesting that Aaron says you're going to know that the Lord brought you out of the land of Egypt when those quail land. It seems like they would already know that, because God had already given them a miraculous deliverance through the Red Sea and has already turned the bitter waters at Marah sweet miraculously. And they still don't know. Well, now when a miraculous load of quail lands in their camp when they're hungry, well, maybe they'll know then. So you got quail coming in the evening. In the morning, you got the manna. In the morning, you'll see the glory of God. What is the glory? Well, it could be the manna itself, and I think that's what it is. It could be, as John Gill says, the Shekinah glory, the Holy Spirit. When you see the pillar of cloud in the morning getting ready to lead you off into the wilderness. Or some people even say it's Jesus himself, because Jesus, according to Hebrews 1:3, is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his nature. Well, I don't think we need to get super spiritual about it. I just think it's talking about the manna. You're going to know God's God in the evening when you see the quail, and in the morning you're going to see the glory of God when you see the manna. That manna is going to be glorious. It's going to be produced by the Lord, and it's glorious. "For here's your grumblings," and the idea is, hey, you're going to stop grumbling when you know that the Lord is the Lord, and you're going to stop grumbling when you see the glory of the Lord. Now, what has Moses said? What are we that you grumble against us? Well, he could be saying, what are you grumbling at us for? We didn't bring you out of Egypt. The Lord did. So what are we? Why are you griping at us? We're not somebody to be grumbled about. If you want to gripe to God, not us. I don't think that's the proper answer. That's a John Gill suggestion. I don't think that's it, because it's true that ultimately God did lead them out, but Moses and Aaron had a part in it too. They were the leaders, and so I don't think Moses and Aaron would think that's a strong argument to say, hey, we didn't really lead you out of Egypt, so why are you grumbling against us? Because they did lead them out of Egypt. I think what they're saying is, look, we are mere men, so you're murmuring against us, but hey, it's not really us that you're grumbling against. You're grumbling against God. There's no point in grumbling against two pitiful little human beings. You are grumbling against God because God brought you here. So direct your anger not to us at mere human beings, but direct your anger at the omnipotent God who brought you out here. And of course, the Moses and Aaron knew they wouldn't do that, but they're saying the logic of your position is, hey, you need to gripe against God because you didn't follow Moses and Aaron into the wilderness because Moses and Aaron were God. You followed Moses and Aaron into the wilderness because you supposedly believed that Yahweh was God. So gripe against him, not us. At any rate, he ends up saying, hey, you gripe against us, but you're not really griping against us. You're griping against the Lord, so you need to think about what you're doing. We go now to Exodus 16, verses 9 through 12. Then Moses said to Aaron, say to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, come near before the Lord, for he has heard your grumblings. It came about as Aaron spoke to the whole congregation of the sons of Israel that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in the cloud. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the grumblings of the sons of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. Again, a very gracious response. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Okay, I'm going to give you bread, and I'm going to give you meat. Manna and quail. Now, all the people of Israel, all the congregation, looked toward the wilderness. That could be the wilderness of sin that was just ahead of them, just to the head and just to the east of them as they left Elam. So that would be the wilderness of sin is south of them as they're heading south, or it could be Mount Sinai, which is to the east of them. So it's either the wilderness of sin or the wilderness around Mount Sinai. Wherever it was, the Shekinah glory cloud was leading them on, and that's why they were looking at the Lord, because the Lord appeared in that cloud, the Shekinah glory. We go to Exodus 16, verses 13 through 16. So it came about at evening that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew evaporated, behold, on the surface of the wilderness there was a fine flake-like thing, fine as the frost on the ground. When the sons of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And of course, manna, that's what manna means in Hebrew. What is it? What is it? And Moses said to them, it is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man as much as he should eat, for you shall take an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. In other words, you got five people in your family, you collect five omers of manna. You got six people in your family, you collect six omers, and so forth. As many as he should eat, is the NASB translation. NIV has as many as is necessary to eat. What does the NIV have? That's not exactly what they say. As much as he needs to eat. So they'll be fulfilled, but they won't have enough to lay up for the future. Now these quails that landed on the Israelites, according to Josephus says these quails lit right among the Hebrews, that they're flying over the Red Sea. That would be over the Gulf of Suez, I guess, flying from west to east. They get worn out flying over the water. They can't land on the water, so they got to keep flying. They get very tired, and then just plop right down as they cross the Gulf of Suez. That makes sense. But, of course, it's still providential because of the timing of it, the geographical location of where these quails came from and landed. Now, the manna is called a flake-like thing in verse 14, like frost on the ground. Now, some have suggested a naturalistic explanation for the manna. For example, some people say that manna was a sticky and granular honeydew secreted by certain insects in early June, and this honeydew solidifies rapidly through evaporation. Well, I don't think a naturalistic explanation will work. It has to be a miracle. Now, here's why. First of all, no naturalistic explanation fits the data, or fits all the data. That's point number one. I'll show you why in a minute. Point number two, the meaning of the Hebrew word manna. Manna means, what is it? Well, if it was something natural, they would probably have known what it was. Now, it's true there are certain things in nature that we don't know what it is. There was a lot of stuff, a lot of vegetables in China I never heard of, a lot of insects too. So, I understand that. But it does seem kind of, it strikes you. Manna, what is it? It doesn't sound something that at least the Hebrews had ever encountered in nature. But even stronger than that is the supernatural daily abundance of manna, which is coupled with its disappearance on Sunday. Natural phenomena don't do that. They don't pick out. Excuse me, not Sunday. What did I call it? Sunday. It's Saturday. The manna disappeared on Saturday. Natural phenomena don't know when Friday, Saturday, or Sunday is. And also notice the manna followed the people everywhere and it never gave out. That's not natural. That's not a natural phenomenon. Also, the appearance and taste of the manna seem to be something not ever experienced before. Exodus 16:31. The house of Israel named it manna, and it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. Well, now they knew what coriander seed was probably, but they named it manna, and so that makes you think that they didn't know exactly what it was. They compared it to coriander seed, which is a spice seed, and they compared its taste to wafers with honey, but it was something they had not really put their fingers on before. So that makes it sound like it was something different, something supernatural. Deuteronomy 8:3, he humbled you and let you be hungry and fed you with manna which you did not know, something they'd never seen before, nor did your fathers know. Deuteronomy 8:16, in the wilderness he fed you manna which your fathers did not know. Okay, so that tends to make you think it's something supernatural that had never been seen before. Also, the keeping of the manna in the ark for future generations, that had to be supernatural because it lasted, whereas something natural would not last without rotting. Exodus 16:33-34, Moses said to Aaron, take a jar and put an omer full of manna in it. Place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. That suggests it was no ordinary food that would be preserved in the ark. So we're going to assume that the manna was supernatural. The omer that each individual could collect was about 2 quarts in English units. And verse 16 says that the manna should be collected an omer apiece according to the number of persons each of you has in his tent. That means if you have 5 family members, you collect 5 omers. If you have 4 family members, you collect 4 omers, and so forth. I say family members, household members. I suppose that would include servants if they had any at that time. We go to Exodus 16:17-18. The sons of Israel did so, and some gathered much and some little. That's because some people's families were bigger, so they gathered much, and some people little because their families were small. When they measured it with an omer, he who had gathered much had no excess, and he who had gathered little had no lack. Every man gathered as much as he should eat, as much as he needed to eat, in other words. Paul quotes that exactly in 2 Corinthians 8:15. He says, he who gathered much did not have too much, and he who gathered little had no lack. And Paul was using that verse to urge wealthier Christians to give to their poor brethren. In other words, poor, we don't want the poor to have a lack. And so if you gathered a whole bunch of manna, well, then you're going to share it with your other family members. And Paul applies that to the poor, your Christian family members, the poor people. They need more stuff, so give it to them. But there was still a basic equality. Some families were bigger than the others, but still, each individual got 1 omer. That was it. No more, no less. He who gathered much had no excess. That's because he had a bigger family, and he didn't have anything left over after all of his family members ate up his 1 omer apiece. We go now to Exodus 16:19-20. Moses said to them, let no man leave any of it until morning. Now, what he meant by that is, don't collect that manna and leave it uneaten. Eat it all. Don't leave it till the next morning, in other words. Verse 20, but they did not listen to Moses, and some left part of it until morning, and it bred worms and became foul. And Moses was angry with them, because naturally the people disobeyed him like they were always doing, and Moses was always stuck with the people's rebellion. He had to present the people to God and say, well, they screwed up again, Lord. Oh, and people want to be leaders. Oh, I wish I was a big shot so I could be up at the front. So I could be teaching every Sunday so everybody could look at me. Now let's say that you had your omer full of manna and you ate 1/2 of it and the other half you didn't want, you weren't hungry. Well, what do you do? Well, you're not going to keep it till the morning because it's going to be nasty and foul and eaten with worms. You could give it away. You could give it to the cattle. You could give it to other people who had eaten 2 omers and wanted some more. The purpose of not allowing the manna to be eaten the next day was to teach the Israelites to rely on God's daily bread. Give us this day our daily bread. Why would somebody try to keep it for the next day? Because they were trying to store up against the future, against untoward events happening in the future, which shows that they're not trusting in God for the future. And oh boy, do I think most Christians have trouble with that one. Now, the manna became foul if it was not eaten on the day it was gathered. But there were two other instances in which the manna did not become foul on the day after it was gathered. For example, from the sixth day to the seventh day. On the seventh day, the manna did not become foul, which has to be miraculous. There's no explanation for that. Also, the manna that was stored in the ark and kept for many ages, as in verse 24, which we're going to read in just a minute, well, that was miraculous. That manna did not become foul, but normally it did. We go to Exodus 16, verses 21 through 26. They gathered it morning by morning, every man as much as he should eat, or as he needed to eat. But when the sun grew hot, it would melt. Now on the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, then he said to them, this is what the Lord meant. Tomorrow is a Sabbath observance, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning. So they put it aside until morning as Moses had ordered, and it did not become foul, nor was there any worm in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there will be none. So on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for each one. Remember, the normal ration was one omer for every person, but now they got two omers for each person. Now notice they had to gather it in the morning, because if they waited till the sun got hot, it would melt the manna. But when it was in its solid state, manna was hard so that it could be beaten in a mortar and ground up in a mill. We know that from Numbers 11:8. The people would go about and gather it and grind it between two millstones or beat it in the mortar and boil it in the pot and make cakes with it, and its taste was as the taste of cakes baked with oil. So apparently the sun would melt the manna and make it worthless. Now the manna was not present on the Sabbath day. Moses said, tomorrow is a Sabbath observance. It was Friday. He says, tomorrow it's going to be Saturday, a Sabbath observance. That's the first time the word is used in the scriptures. But as the NIV Study Bible says, the concept of a Sabbath was in the Genesis account of creation, because God rested on the seventh day after he created. So now we have the concept of the Sabbath before the law, actually the mention of the Sabbath before the law. Because remember now, we haven't gotten to Mount Sinai yet, so the law has not been given. That's going to happen a couple months later. So there was a Sabbath observance before the law existed. So the idea of mankind needing a day of rest is not just a Mosaic Old Covenant thing. It's something that's built into our nature. And again, I'm not going to talk about what day of the Sabbath was or what does it mean to rest on the Sabbath. I'm just going to say that 1 out of 7 days we need to rest, because this idea was in creation, not in the Mosaic law alone. It was also in creation. Adam Clark mentioned something interesting. He says that there's a controversy over whether this is the first Sabbath or not. Some people say so, but other people say that the Sabbath was well known by the people before then, and that this is a mere renewal of the Sabbath covenant. I don't know, and if it's a renewal, then the people would have forgotten it because of the unsettled state in the wilderness, which might have tempted them to think that the Sabbath no longer applied. I don't know what I think about all that. I'm just going to assume this is the first time that they had a Sabbath, and it was taught to them here. The Sabbath rest was taught by the manna. So the manna taught daily bread, and the manna taught Sabbath rest. Two things. Now a little minor point here. The fact that the extra manna on the sixth day became foul, that indicates that the extra manna collected on the sixth day was not baked or boiled like manna normally was, because if it were baked or boiled, then it would not be a miracle that it wasn't rotten the next day. It became rotten the next day, so it wasn't baked or boiled. If it baked or boiled, it wouldn't be rotten. So let's summarize the miracles involved with the manna. First of all, that the manna even fell. That's the first miracle. The second miracle is that no manna fell on the seventh day. And the third miracle is that the sixth-day manna was preserved from putrefaction, from being putrefied, from being rotten on the seventh day. So three miracles involved with manna. We go now to Exodus 16, verses 27 through 30. It came about on the seventh day that some of the people went out to gather, but they found none, no manna. Then the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? And I would say, wait a minute, that's not Moses. That's not Moses that's not keeping God's command. It's the Israelites. How long do you, that's plural. How long do you, plural. How long do you, Israelites? So it's not just Moses God is complaining to, but it seems even strange that he would even implicate Moses in the transgression. But again, leaders a lot of times take the heat for what their subordinates do, just like in business. How long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my instructions? God says to Moses. Verse 29, see, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. God is still speaking. Therefore, he gives you bread for 2 days on the sixth day. Remember every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. Remain every man in his place. Let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Now, when God complains to Moses that the Israelites are not keeping God's commandments, which commandment was he referring to? Well, I think the context says he's referring to the Sabbath breach here. Some people say he could be referring to the whole series of disobediences that occurred after they left Egypt, and it could be that, but I think he's more particularly talking about the Sabbath breach here. Now, in verse 27, it says the people went out to gather on the seventh day, which they weren't supposed to do. Why would they do that? Well, it could be they didn't lay up any extra on the sixth day as they were ordered to do, and so they were hungry. They didn't have anything left over. Well, that would be disobedience. It could be they were greedy. They had laid up extra on the sixth day, but they wanted even more, so they went out on the seventh day. Or it could be they weren't hungry at all. They were just going out to satisfy their curiosity to see if Moses really knew what he was talking about. He said there wasn't going to be any manna on the seventh day, but it's been here Monday through Friday, or Sunday through Friday. The manna's there. It seems strange that it won't be here on Saturday, on the Sabbath. So let's go out there and check and see. And so they went out there to look. That's reasonable. Any reason could be, or a combination of those reasons why some people went out there on the Sabbath day. But whatever, for whatever reason they did it, they weren't supposed to. It was wrong. Verse 30, so the people rested on the seventh day. Now, Adam Clark and John Gill make an interesting point. They say it's interesting how commentators like to say Israelites did religious exercises on the seventh day. It does not say that. In verse 30, it says the people rested on the seventh day. It doesn't say they went to church or they went to synagogue. They didn't have synagogue or church then, of course. They didn't do anything. They didn't offer sacrifice. They just rested. And so these people who say that we got to on Sunday, which is problematical because the original Sabbath was on Saturday, but these people that say that on Sunday we're supposed to go to church on Sunday because of the Sabbath law. No. If you want to make an argument for that, just look at the pattern in the New Testament that on the Lord's Day they gathered together to eat the bread, eat the Lord's Supper. Okay, that's fine. Gathered together on Sunday for the Lord's Day, but not because of the Sabbath law. It has nothing to do with Sunday. Nothing at all. Saturday in the Old Testament was, the Sabbath in the Old Testament was Saturday. And the people didn't do religious exercises on Saturday. They rested. Now, of course, the idea of the Sabbath, it became such a legalistic disaster in the history of Israel. I got some interesting examples. Adam Clark says some Jews were so righteous about the Sabbath that they wouldn't move from their wake-up posture on the Sabbath. So in other words, they opened their eyes, and wherever their body was, it froze right there and didn't move all day. Now, that's pretty absurd. Clark gives another example of a Jew that fell into a ditch and stayed there all day until the Sabbath was over. Oh, I'm in the ditch. I can't work to climb out of the ditch. Well, I mean, even today in Israel, I was in a hotel. It was Saturday, the Sabbath. I needed to go down, and doggone, half the darn buttons on the elevator didn't work. It had something to do with electricity. Can't use electricity on the Sabbath. I forgot how they got around that problem, I think. I don't know how they got around that problem. I can't remember. I just remember thinking it was absurd. But legalism is absurd, folks. It's absurd. We go now to Exodus 16, 31 through 32. The house of Israel named it manna. And it was like coriander seed, white, and its taste was like wafers with honey. Then Moses said, this is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer full of it be kept throughout your generations, that they may see the bread that I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And we'll see that the omer full of manna was going to be kept in the Ark of the Testimony, the Ark of the Covenant. And it's an omer full so that not only the content of that golden jar of manna would remind the Israelites of the manna that they ate in the wilderness, but the quantity of it would remind them also, an omer full. Now remember, manna means what is it? It says it was like coriander seed. It wasn't coriander seed, but it was like it. It was white. Its taste was like wafers with honey, but not exactly. This was something sui generis. It was something unique. Manna was compared to other white things like hoarfrost, frost in verse 14 above. In Numbers 11:7, it's referred to as bdellium, which is pearl. Numbers 11:7, now the manna was like coriander seed in its appearance like that of bdellium, pearl, but basically it was white. John Gill has a point. Coriander seed isn't white. I've got a picture of it from Wikipedia right here in my notes, and it's kind of a pale yellow looking. It's not white. So Gill says, well, maybe that the manna is like coriander seed, not in its color, but in its shape. The particles were round like coriander seed. Could be. Or it could be that the translation of the Hebrew word gad is not coriander, but it's a reference to another kind of seed we don't know about. Or it could be that it was not white, but it was close to white, and that was close enough. I don't know. Who cares? The point is that it was something unique that people didn't really know about. Now, in verse 32, God says, keep an omer full of this manna so that the Israelites will see the bread that they were fed with. Well, in Hebrews 9:4, we read where that bread was kept. We're going to see it also in the next couple of verses here in chapter 16, but let's take a peek at Hebrews 9:4. Having a golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which, in other words, in the Ark of the Covenant, was a golden jar holding the manna, as well as Aaron's rod, which budded in the tables of the covenant. So a golden jar holding the manna is where the manna was kept to remind the Israelites. We go to verses 33 through 35. Moses said to Aaron, take a jar. And the book of Hebrews says it was a golden jar. Put an omer full of manna in it. Again, the quantity reminds the Israelites as well as the content. Put an omer full of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony. The testimony is short for Ark of the Testimony. Testimony was the tablets of the law that Moses received on Mount Sinai. They put the tablets of the law into the Ark. And so it was called the Ark of the Testimony. In other words, the Ark which contains the tablets of the law. The Ark which contains the testimony of the law. And then they just shorten it to the testimony. So the Ark of the Testimony is the Ark. So Aaron placed it before the Ark, before the testimony to be kept. The sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years until they came to an inhabited land. They ate the manna until they came to the border of the land of Canaan. This idea of the Ark of the testimony being a shortened form of the Ark of Testimony, we can see that in Exodus 25:22. There I will meet with you, and from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which upon the Ark of the Testimony, in other words, the Ark which contains the tablets of the testimony. Exodus 26:33, you shall hang up the veil under the clasp and shall bring in the Ark of the Testimony, the Ark which contains the tablets of the law, the Ark of the Testimony of the law. So that is a common phrase. Why is it called a testimony of the law? Because it contained the testimony of the mind and will of God to Israel, because that's what the law was. Adam Clark says it was also a testimony of good things to come to Israel. Now I'm going to insert here something that's totally irrelevant to our passage, but it's interesting. It's from Adam Clark. He says that some people think that the tabernacle which contained that ark was a renewal of a tabernacle built in patriarchal times. I've never heard that before. I don't know who says that there was a tabernacle in patriarchal times. I don't believe it. I think that's a product of an overactive imagination. At any rate, we go to verse 35, and we see that the sons of Israel ate the manna 40 years. That's actually a round number because they precisely ate the manna 39 years and 11 months, if you do the calculations, as John Gill has done. Actually, Moses died before the manna ceased, so someone else, perhaps Joshua, Ezra, wrote this part as an addendum, as John Gill and Adam Clark suggest. John Gill suggests that perhaps even Moses spoke prophetically, but I don't think so. It's probably just an addendum added to the text. We see precisely when the manna was ended, after Moses had died and the Israelites crossed the Jordan, Joshua 5, verses 10 through 12, while the sons of Israel camped at Gilgal, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month on the desert plains of Jericho. On the day after the Passover, on that very day, they ate some of the produce of the land, unleavened cakes and parched grain. The manna ceased on the day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land, so that the sons of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate some of the yield of the land of Canaan during that year. So in other words, when they got to inhabited land, cultivated land, they didn't need the manna anymore because in an inhabited area they had cultivated grain. You have that, you don't need to eat supernatural manna, you eat natural grain, and that illustrates the principle. Where there is no supernatural provision, God will use natural means to provide. But when the natural means run out, then you have to depend on supernatural provision, which God is gracious to give, of course. And of course, we can apply that to a lot of areas, but especially healing, you know, because doctors, yeah, you should use all natural means that you can to get healed by a doctor. But let's face it, medical science is flying blind a lot of times, despite the miracles of modern medical science, like heart problems. Good gravy. They put a stent in your heart and give. I just talked to somebody last night, had 19 years added to her life. She's perfectly healthy, and she had a 95% occlusion in the Widowmaker, that artery that blocks when it's blocked, it kills you. She was vomiting and nauseous and sweating and carried out of house in an ambulance. It's a miracle she lived, but she's been perfectly well for 19 years. That shows that medicine can do miracles, but there's a lot of stuff that medicine has no clue as to how to fix. So if you're in a situation where you're sick and the doctors have done everything they can, you got no choice but to provide on supernatural provision. But on the other hand, I remember when I was in a charismatic group at college, and it was so exciting because the miraculous was considered to be on the table, and I saw miracles in the midst of a rationalistic university, rationalistic family upbringing, and so it was so nice to see miracles. But then some people just took a good idea and carried it too far, and they were asking for prophetic vision as to when they should go brush their teeth and things like that. Well, no, you do things naturally without supernatural provision or direction or guidance. But when the natural stuff wears out, to rely on God, rely on the grace, on the grace of God. So that's what happened to the Israelites here. The manna was finished when they got to inhabited land in Israel. Now we finish up with verse 36, Exodus 16. Now an omer is a tenth of an ephah. Now that verse will really enhance your relationship with God. An omer is a tenth of an ephah. Well, the omer is what the Israelites collected in manna, one a day. So if an omer is a tenth of an ephah, that means, and a omer is 2 quarts, then an ephah would be about 20 quarts. And the $64 million question is, why in the world does Moses put this here? Now, verse 36 in the NASB is put in parentheses. Well, here's a possible explanation to explain the omer, which was mentioned frequently in the account, to emphasize the amount that was gathered daily. An omer, because it's mentioned over and over again to show how much. Now, everybody knew what an ephah was. Perhaps they weren't so sure what a omer was, but they knew what the ephah was, so an omer is a tenth of that, so then they could judge how much they were supposed to pick up when they collected the manna. And they would also be reminded, when they were familiar with the omer unit, that this is how much the Israelites could daily pick up, and so therefore it would remind them of the miracle of the manna. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Exodus chapter 16. In our next chapter, chapter 17, verses 1 through 16, the entire chapter, we will look at the incidents of water from the rock at Rephidim and the Israelites' victory over Amalek. See you next time. Hope you enjoyed this audio.